Therapy Notes is the highest rated EHR, practice management, and billing software for mental health professionals. Its all-in-one platform is designed to streamline all aspects of your practice, from connecting with clients via secure messages to scheduling, notes, billing, and more. You can trust Therapy Notes has you covered. And one of the best parts? 24/7 customer service with a live person. It's beyond easy to get help over the phone or by email at any time of day from their knowledgeable and friendly representatives. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
Therapists, ready to stop just listening and start doing? I offer several ways to work with me and accelerate your trauma expertise. You can join my Trauma Therapist Network membership community for ongoing support, book a one-on-one clinical consultation with me for personalized guidance, or buy my course for clinicians on supporting survivors of sexual trauma, and check out the retreats coming up in 2026. All that info and more is on the For Therapists page of Trauma Therapist Network, and you can find a link in the show notes.
Therapy Chat Podcast, Episode 516.
This is the Therapy Chat Podcast with Laura Reagan, LCSWC. The information shared in this podcast is not a substitute for seeking help from a licensed mental health professional. And now, here's your host, Laura Reagan, LCSWC.
Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and we continue our discussion of caring for self as a helping professional. I feel like this topic is more urgent than ever during the time that I've been podcasting. So these 10 years, it's more urgent than ever for all of us who are helping professionals to be ensuring that we're tending to ourselves. We are all living through intensely challenging times where we are being exposed to traumatic material and horrific, terrifying information at a pace that is completely overwhelming to our nervous systems. And the collective consciousness is vibrating with the tension of the injustice and domination, energy, oppression, alongside hopefully all of the things that you are finding joy in, all of the ways that you are staying connected to yourself and those around you, the people you love, your community, your neighbors, the people who work in the places that you go. This is life. It's not in our phones. It's around us. And we have to engage with it. We have to engage with our bodies, with the earth, with our connection with our fellow beings, animals, people, plants. So this week, in that spirit, I just returned from Costa Rica, where I allowed the earth to hold me and to connect with someone I love, as well as myself. Did it make everything all better? No, not at all. But it helped me. It was a recentering, rewilding my spirit, reminding myself the animal that I am and what really matters in life. So I'm doing what I need to do, and I hope you're doing what you need to do. Maybe you'll be inspired by this conversation, which is a replay from several years ago, pre-pandemic, I believe. Conversation is about clinician self-care as social justice. And my guest is Dr. Rebecca Eldridge. So for all of us who think that tending to ourselves is selfish or self-indulgent in such times, the opposite is true. It's a requirement. And I hope that this conversation will remind you of how you can get back to doing what you need if you have temporarily lost your way. Next week, we'll be back with a new episode, which I can't wait to share with you. So until then, take good care. Hi, welcome back to Therapy Chat. I'm your host, Laura Reagan, and today I'm so pleased to be speaking with Dr. Rebecca Eldridge. Rebecca, thank you so much for being my guest on Therapy Chat today.
Oh, I've been really looking forward to it.
Me too. I'm really interested in talking about your work and learning more about what you do and how it can help leaders and helping professionals. But before we really get into it, will you just take a moment to tell our audience a little more about who you are and what you do?
I'd be glad to. So I am going to just start out saying I come from a very privileged background. If you think about across the diversity spectrum, I am privileged in just about every aspect of my identity, with the exception perhaps of gender, being female. And so a lot of times people are surprised that I do the work that I do and that I have the passion and the history of focusing on multicultural issues in my work. And it seems like it's chosen me as much as I've chosen it over the years. Just a buildup of amazing, wonderful experiences. But I began wanting to tailor my work in psychology actually in the seventh grade. So I'm one of the very few people that somehow guessed what I was going to want to be when I grew up, and that it continued to fit for how much I love getting to know, getting to listen and understand different people's experiences, and then try to offer support in any challenges that they're feeling internally or externally. And that led me into a graduate program that supported my multicultural focus. And there was this one moment early in my training where I was assigned to work with a client. I'll just give this example because this was such a key moment in describing where I started and how I continue to love my work. I was assigned to work with this client who is a Black woman. And when I invited her to come speak with me, she told me, no, I don't want to. And she was very clear and very direct about it. And as a trainee, I was kind of caught because on the one hand, I knew that as a very light-skinned, very fair, very young, new professional, that there could be many reasons that she did not want to speak with me or feel like I would be able to understand her story. And fortunately, she agreed that we could just step aside for 5 minutes. We stepped into another room. I don't even think we sat down at first, Laura. I think we just stood there because I knew she did not want to be there with me. But she shared just enough to say, in general terms, that her work was really stressful and that she was having some of these interactions with people. And fortunately, I had great training, great supervision up to that point, and heard and knew enough to say, that sounds like discrimination. How do you experience it? And everything changed in that moment. She let me in. She honored me with the rest of her story and experience. She went on to willingly meet with me for the rest of that hour and an additional time before she left the group program that this was a part of. And she made decisions to see her own worth more clearly and to honor that and to say no to the way that she was being disrespected and marginalized in her workplace, and to take her leadership and her brilliance elsewhere. And that moment, just the feelings of that transformation of being honored when people let me into their stories, into their lives, and being able to really bear witness to the hardships and the injustices that they've experienced, as well as their brilliance and everything that they have to offer to the world, just has continued to build ever since then. That was, you know, like 20 years ago or so now. And that continues to be the type of work that I do and love doing, whether it's with individuals or organizations, of just supporting people who care so deeply and have so much strength to make a difference, and yet are also often the people that are carrying the burdens of the injustices that they're trying to change.
That is a powerful point, that the people often who are out there trying to make change are frequently directly impacted by the same concerns that they're trying to address.
Yeah, I hope and I believe that maybe there's a slight shift that we're seeing in that, of more people having people that they love and they care about of different backgrounds and starting to take stands on issues, even if it's not a part of their direct identity or experience. And certainly most of the time what I see is that people from marginalized groups are carrying the weight of the burden for change.
Yes. I mean, we certainly see that in movements like Black Lives Matter, you know, and I think about that so often, the toll on activists It's exhausting.
It is. And it's really creating such a toll, as you said, for the people doing so much work and that have so much to offer, but are constantly getting shut down in the process, either by the responses that they're getting around them or by their own nervous system getting so overwhelmed and overloaded that it just can't keep showing up in the same way.
Right. So exactly, with a nervous system impact, we who have experienced trauma and most of the causes that people are out there trying to do activism around relate in some way to trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So having experiences of trauma and then going and trying to make a difference, whether it's direct work with people or it's legislative advocacy or on the streets advocacy, activism, our nervous systems are feeling the impact. It's not something you can just avoid.
No, and it's very hard at times to really shelter and nurture our nervous systems back to safety. It can be really challenging when there's triggers that can come from all directions at any time, any conversation. It can be friends, it can be family, it can be clients, it can be coworkers, neighbors. I mean, it just right now is so prevalent. I know we were just talking a little while ago about examples of that, and there's such strong divisive stances that have been taken politically that it can just make it really hard to kind of get your balance again before the next thing comes at you.
Yeah, it really feels that way. I would say before the pandemic, it was feeling like there was a bombardment of both outrageous actions that caused people to feel outraged and a lot of loud conflict everywhere, you know, in so many different fronts in our culture here in the U.S., but it's around the world.
Right. Yeah, it is. It's international in all sorts of different ways. Some commonalities among the issues and some that are unique to different areas, but it's so widespread.
Yeah. So can you say a little bit about how you work with people? What types of work do you do?
Well, I love variety in all parts of my life. So my work is an extension of that as well. I do individual therapy and coaching. I also do speaking and facilitation or trainings, workshops, whether for, you know, organizations or small groups that are looking to kind of pursue this integration of wellness and social justice. You know, this bridge between how do we take care of ourselves as we're continuing to try to show up and have our most effective and sustainable impact in the world around us. So I'm so fortunate. I work with such amazing people and organizations who care about their change makers, you know, they're themselves and what's important to them, the values that they hold, the people that they want to show up for, or at the organizational level, organizations that really see we have this portion of our staff, of our employees, or that are kind of tasked with, whether it's a diversity committee or a DEI group, you know, that are tasked with bringing about big changes, often against big obstacles and the toll that takes, and wanting to support those people so that they don't lose those people. I mean, we see so many people. I think I saw that nearly 50%, nearly half of the population of employed people are actively looking or interested in leaving their jobs. And so when companies know that's such a high risk, at the same time that they're trying to get more diversity representation, if they really mean that beyond just words, then these are some of the key people that they really need to be watching and protecting the well-being of. So I get to work with people across all different levels and layers, and people that really, once, when they're taking care of themselves, when they have the opportunity to even learn to feel and understand their emotions in different ways, it just can bring even more of their brilliance into the world.
That's wonderful. And one thing I've seen mentioned quite a bit in reference to like big corporations and diversity, equity, and inclusion initiatives is, you know, the person of color being
say there's one person of color on a team, it's like, you're the DEI lead now. And they're like, really? Right. And also, like, I'm the one who's impacted by this and I have to go and teach everyone, or like,
right.
And then oftentimes, and certainly I hope not in the groups that you're working for, but like, I hear people say it's kind of a lip service effort. You know, they right. say they want diversity and inclusion and equity, but I told them where the gaps were and I mm-hmm. created this big plan and they just kind of brushed it aside. And that's like deeply wounding to put that
right.
effort in and have it just be kind of dismissed.
Yes. I mean, I was talking to somebody who's actually, you know, the chief equity officer for a large organization recently, doing amazing work, has a team. He was describing the different elements of the work that they're doing for this organization. Just incredible work. And he was saying, like, yes, like, who's taking care of this team? You know, he's trying to check in on them. He's more seasoned, been in the field longer. He knows what a toll it takes. And he's seeing people that are relatively new in their careers and noticing they're already kind of looking like, oh, okay, this is hard. And so even in an organization where they have people that are hired specifically to be in these roles, there's still this pushback of maybe some of the leadership wants it and values it, but that might not be the person's direct manager who's saying like, oh, you have to go to another meeting, or, oh, this is taking time away from your other work. Like, okay, it's fine as long as you're still getting just as much done just as quickly as you would if you weren't doing this other, you know, diversity effort or initiative. And so there's this mismatch that really leaves people in a push and pull. And as you said, can be very wounding, re-traumatizing as people experience some of the same rejection that might be repetitive of earlier experiences or ongoing experiences in many cases.
Yeah. I felt like when you said, as long as you can get your other work done, I just felt immediately like, oh, but what about the impact, the emotional impact of the DEI work they're doing? When do they get to recover from that before they have to do the other work again? You know?
Right.
Don't forget to give me that report that was due on Friday.
Exactly. Like, you know, okay, like, that's fine. It looks good for the company, but make sure your other work isn't slipping. Make sure you're not missing any other meetings. And the fact that, you know, for a lot of people, it's not just a job. Like, it's maybe a job and it's also their lived experience. So they don't leave the job and get to turn that part of their work off. Like, then they go out into the world where they're continuing to experience the same thing in their interactions.
Yeah. So how do you work with people? What types of, well, let me back up. When we were talking before, we talked about you sort of saying that taking care of your nervous system is basically a social justice imperative. So for people who are doing social justice work, it's not optional to tend to that part of you. But can you talk about that a bit?
Yes, absolutely. That's such a core of my work. So, and I say core, and I'm literally picturing, like, I have a model for kind of change making and cultural competence that has different layers to it. And this layer is literally like the core, the heart of it, because all of the other layers become less effective or less impactful if you're not taking care of compassion for yourself, compassion for others, that core of the nervous system of how do you sit with your own feelings, your own sensations, how do you create safety for yourself internally, and how do you do that for the intense emotions and experiences of others. And so people often want to skip to an action stage. You know, I want to know what to do. Just tell me what to do. Or I'm trying to do this, I'm doing. And yet, if it's not kind of grounded in this being able to recenter, being able to tune into what is this telling me? How is this actually helping me to feel what I'm feeling right now? And I totally get that that's like such a big ask and sometimes so counterintuitive from what people have felt or believed about their emotions and their nervous system before, like where it's more of a battle, that something that they have to escape from or fight back against or try to avoid at all costs because of the fear that it will just capsize them entirely. And instead, really viewing that as the lighthouse, as learning to watch for the cues of your emotions in your body as something that can actually help to guide you safely toward what you really care about, toward that impact that you want to have, because you can then arrive with less damage in the process. You know, so many people go into these like start and stop, like I gotta go, I gotta do something, I, you know, like I really have to act on this, I need to make a change, and then before long completely depleted, saying like I can't look at another news story, I can't do anything, like it just, I need 6 months off before I'm gonna feel like I'm myself again, and then go back into later another action stage. But that takes such a toll. And I just love to help people find the way to change their relationship to their emotions and their nervous system so that they can work with it instead of against it, and then be able to move forward in kind of more of a regular rhythm for the impact that they want to have. And how I do that? Did you want me to say specifics?
That would be lovely. I mean, because I'm very intrigued about that. What you described with the, you know, you feel like you want to take action, then you feel like you're shutting down. So it's like you're describing being out mm-hmm. of your window of tolerance on right. either the hyper arousal or hypo arousal, but it can be so, can overtake you.
Yeah. So I love a lot of Deb Dana's work. I love a lot of Kristen Neff's work. I mean, things around self-compassion, things around the nervous system. I mean, I draw from a lot of brilliant people that are doing amazing work, and then integrating those pieces to help people change the relationship by first just kind of building a different relationship with their emotions. I do use a lot of metaphors too, but like
if nothing wrong with that.
If your emotion's not your enemy, if your emotion is actually trying to tell you something that's really helpful for you to know, you know, if our computer tells us we have a virus on it, like that's helpful to know so that we can do something differently. And same thing with our emotions. So for some people, it's really being able to recognize feelings. For some people, it's really tuning into the physiological sensations, what's going on in your body. So I love experiential approaches. So I use a lot of felt sense. I've done training in EFT and emotional freedom technique. So that's one of the things that I love, for seeing what an impact it can have on people, even in the moment, to kind of connect to what's feeling bad while at the same time immediately decreasing a lot of the intensity and feeling better and coming to different ways of looking at things. And I love also Deb Dana's nervous system ladder. So doing a lot of just helping people when I'm working with people individually, really helping people to change that relationship by getting practice with how to listen for and tune into what their body is telling them. And I think I've heard you talk before about, you know, some of the books like The Body Keeps the Score, things like that. And, you know, so I love everything that I can learn about neuroscience and making that really applicable to people's everyday lives.
Therapy Notes is consistently transforming the way therapists manage their practices with continuous updates designed to save money and improve efficiency. Their latest game changer, Therapy Fuel, a powerful and fully integrated suite of AI tools that streamline documentation so you can focus more on your clients. With AI features that help by generating progress notes from summaries or transcriptions, creating contact notes directly from clients' secure messages, and automated summaries of client history forms, Therapy Notes users are already reporting hours of saved time and energy. Some other recent feature improvements include automated recurring client payments, electronic secondary insurance billing, and their constantly expanding library of outcome measures. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
therapists ready to stop just listening and start doing. I offer several ways to work with me and accelerate your trauma expertise. You can join my Trauma Therapist Network membership community for ongoing support, book a one-on-one clinical consultation with me for personalized guidance, or buy my course for clinicians on supporting survivors of sexual trauma, and check out the retreats coming up in 2026. All that info and more is on the For Therapists page of Trauma Therapist Network, and you can find a link in the show notes.
Yeah, because we all have a nervous system, no matter who you are, and it gets dysregulated, no matter who you are. But I understand now that it wants to, it's always seeking to get back to a state of, you know, wellness in some way.
Yeah. And when we can, you know, thinking about the window of tolerance or the nervous system ladder, thinking about it, the more you can recognize the landmarks for, oh, you know, I suddenly seem to be in the land of sympathetic nervous system now. Or, you know, I, for example, get really clumsy when I'm in more of a nervous system sympathetic state. And so that can be one of the clues. Like if I notice I'm starting to drop things or trip over things or whatever, I'm like, okay, like, let me just slow down for a minute and figure out what's going on, what needs my attention here. And being intentional about it feels so much better because I feel so much more comfortable with my emotions, you know, even the really strong emotions, knowing that, you know, I can listen to them and work with them has been a game changer for me. And I see it being a game changer for so many clients time after time, where they can make amazing decisions that are good for their life because they've been able to recognize the signs of being dysregulated and then get back to more of that calm, connected space where they can problem solve and they can think clearly and they can look at what they need differently.
Yeah, that's so hopeful because, you know, things can be really discouraging sometimes.
Yes, absolutely. And we don't have, I don't know if other people would see this differently. Listeners can answer this for themselves, I guess. But in my experience, we don't have a ton of great models for healthy relationships to our emotions. We, you know, our parents often haven't had that, our grandparents, you know, our ancestors, like, you know, it's hard to develop a sense of trust and comfort with the uncomfortable parts of our feelings if that's never been modeled or taught to us. And so people can often be pretty exhausted by the process before they get a chance to say, oh, wait, you mean like this isn't totally trying to thwart my efforts or like drown me in overwhelm? Like if I slow down and feel this, it's not going to completely incapacitate me. Like that's hard to believe at first if you haven't had a chance to experience it.
Yeah, it does feel like that. I know for me, like there are certain things where it's like, you're afraid to feel something because you're afraid that if you feel it, you won't come back from it. It'll swallow you up and that'll be it.
Yes, for sure. You will be in the belly of the whale.
Yeah.
And you're never coming out again. Yeah. Yeah, totally.
Well, I think it's interesting that a lot of the work you do is within the context of people in their work environment. Because, you know, at work, especially in corporate settings, but really in, you know, it's a general rule that at work, you're expected to just like, you're at work, this is business, do your work. It's not about being emotional. It's not about, you know, it's about efficiency. It's detached from emotion. It's like fast and effective. And, you know, I mean, even in the therapy world, our work is emotions. But we're on, you know, there's a tight time schedule, you know, our boundaries are supposed to be really solid, you know, there's get your notes done. There's always so many things that don't seem to account for the fact that your child was sick and you're worried about them at daycare, not knowing if they're going to feel okay or if somebody's going to be kind to them if they're, you know, if their stomach's upset or something like that. And that's like a tiny example. I mean, there are things that can have so much more weight than that, living with racial violence and racism. And, you know, you leave your house and you get to work and what happened in between that time. And then you show up and you're supposed to just be a professional and do your job and do it well. Then if you're struggling in some way, everyone's like, oh, you're struggling. Is this job right for you? Maybe you should, maybe you're not cut out for this, you know?
Right. And that's even if they're willing to consider this like struggling as a temporary, like you're struggling versus labeling you or stereotyping
right.
you in some more pervasive characterological way. And
very true.
And so, I mean, I'm totally with you on that. And for therapists or helping professionals too, where your job is showing up for other people again and again and holding space for all of the emotions and experiences and hardships that they're going through. And again, trying to separate and set aside any of those things you mentioned, any of the parts of your identity or experience that you're in the middle of coping with. It's hard. It's a big ask.
And one of the things many therapists struggle with, and people have been talking about this throughout the pandemic, but it's, again, it's much beyond the pandemic, that when our clients are distraught about something that's happening in the outside world, if we have a history with that, or if we're currently, even more so, I think it's difficult if we're currently impacted by that thing. Easy example is a Black therapist who's working with a Black client, and the client is talking about experiences of racism, and the therapist is remembering and feeling everything of their own experiences with racism. And then there's so many, you know, layers of other, as you've said, identities that, you know, the therapist could be feeling shame about their privilege to have had a different experience than their client, or wanting to relate to the client, and or feeling like the client's experience isn't as bad as what they've been through, or just being distracted by their own feelings about the pain that they're witnessing and feeling inside of themselves. And, you know, any form of abuse, oppression, violence done from one person to another, we can have these experiences. It's just like, I'm hearing therapists just saying, like, my capacity to hold space is really limited.
Yes, I definitely am hearing that too. And, you know, I think we're seeing maybe this extension of compassion fatigue in the recent environment of, you know, compassion fatigue, I know has been around for a very long time. I know it was in my thesis. Ages and ages ago, you know, but when we're looking at that, sometimes our compassion fatigue really costs us our connection to our emotions, you know, that we just get so depleted by feeling so much without a space for that to heal or to go or to release, that then kind of cutting off or disconnecting becomes the coping strategy, you know, becomes the way to survive. And yet then it cuts us off not only from our internal experiences, perhaps, but also from the very relationships and people and work and efforts that we really are wanting to have to make our life meaningful. And most people that I know are not in therapy for the money that they're making as a therapist. So, you know, when you're in a profession because you cared so much and really wanted to be able to support others, and yet then you're so depleted that one of your main motivations for doing what you're doing is being compromised, then, I mean, I think we're looking at a big impact, like a big systemic impact on that level too, when our change makers, our caring professionals, our helping professionals are getting so worn out, so overloaded, and not having the opportunities to really refuel to keep going.
Yeah. Do you have any suggestions about how people can make more, I don't know if it's making more space or just creating more opportunities for healing and recovery, but also it feels like connecting to more joy and play too, like those mm-hmm. types of things seems to be an important aspect.
I mean, I love where you're going with it already. Yeah. You can answer this for me, I think. And I think a lot of us therapists, a lot of us helping professionals know the answers, right? So I don't feel like I'm going to have some, like, you know, the heavens are going to open up and shower down a light on anything that I'm about to say. I also feel like it's somewhat individual. So, yeah. You know, I feel like we know we help other people with this. Sometimes it's just that tension of being able to take our own advice to some extent, of doing the things that we know and see again and again help for others, But because we're so busy often, maybe, you know, we might care for people all day and then we go home and care for more people, you know, whether it's aging parents or children or friends, you know, whether it's taking in the news and really caring and crying and feeling the grief of people suffering on the other side of the world, you know, that it's hard to get a break from that and not feel, perhaps I hear a lot of people feel guilty about it or feel like, well, how can I take a break? How can I do something for me that wouldn't be fair? Like people around me are needing me. They're relying on me. Like I can't afford to let up or else somebody who's depending on me is going to suffer for it. And so we get into that, almost that paradox where we feel like we can't do the things we know to do for ourselves because we're so busy doing for and helping for everybody else. And the flip side of that is that, yeah, if we could slow down and play, have fun, listen to or watch something for laughter, you know, get outside and connect to nature in some way. I know for me, if I can look at water or sky, you know, just being able to look at something that's so constant and so changing all the time and really connect to what is it looking like in this moment, using our senses, you know, if there's something, even if it's something simple, like a glass of water, but really slowing down to notice it. And for me, it comes back, I'm kind of a broken record on this, but to the relationship we have with our emotions and our nervous system, where they can tell us what we need, because there might be sometimes where what we need is quiet and calm and 5 minutes to breathe, you know, to calm down and recenter ourselves, that can make a huge difference for the next hour, two, three, you know, even the rest of our day. And other times we might need like action, like I really need to expend some energy here. And we don't know unless we're able to tune in and listen to what our body and our emotions are telling us. I also think, you know, sometimes if you can simplify things, like I know I'm somebody who tends to make things more complicated than they need to be quite often. And part of that is because I really do value and appreciate complexity and not oversimplifying things. At the same time, like sometimes it's okay to say, where can I take a load off? Like what doesn't need to be done? Or even on a cognitive load, like one of the things that I know people get stuck with is I want to always be able to respond in a moment where I see or hear something hateful or a microaggression or an injustice of some sort being said. But it's exhausting. Like it's such a heavy lift to come up with. What am I going to say this time? This time it's my boss. This time it's my neighbor. This time it's my parent. Like, you know, that a lot of times there's this weight on the relationships where we're having those conversations, and somebody who cares a lot about social justice, we don't want to be complicit. We don't want to just stay silent either. And so, you know, I hear a lot of people like in that sense, really getting either down on themselves for not having something more brilliant to say, for not speaking up faster, for feeling like, you know, they attacked back, but it didn't really go anywhere. There was nothing effective that came out of the conversation. And, you know, that's something that I actually created a download for. And if anybody finds themselves relating to that experience, they're welcome to download that. But, you know, sometimes just looking for, is there a tool out there? Is there a way that I can make this a little bit easier on myself or feel a little bit more confident and prepared for some of the things that are weighing on me?
That's a great suggestion with me, because if you hear a microaggression or hateful thing that someone says, that's likely to trigger something in you right away because you care about it. And when that gets activated, you can't really access your thinking so well. So having like a simple guide of things to something you can just pull out of your pocket. Literally, you're not pulling a piece of paper out of your pocket, but because you've already like looked at it and you're like, oh, I know what I can say here. Because I think what happens is we try to address something. Sometimes someone will try to address something with someone in their family or a friend, and then it just becomes frustrating. The other person's not really getting it or they don't want to hear it. And then you feel like giving up. And you just want to distance yourself from that person, which maybe that might be the right thing to be would be to distance yourself from them if they're consistently this way and they have no desire to change. But that doesn't mean, you know, you have to feel disempowered and hopeless and helpless.
Right.
If you can stay centered.
Yeah. And I mean, I do have a bias. I mean, I have a lot of biases, but one of my biases is that we can't afford to cut everybody off that we disagree with every time. So while there are situations where a relationship is really unhealthy or toxic, or like, you know, it's harmful to engage and a boundary is completely appropriate, that if everybody who says something that we don't like or disagree with becomes somebody that we don't talk to anymore or don't talk to about that anymore, then our change making is really going to stall out, because we really need to be bringing more people into the process and distributing the weight a little bit more widespread, so that if everybody's having some conversations here and there that are effective, that we can move the needle more quickly.
Yeah. And I think to that point, you know, there's the tension between who should be talking about this. You know, should white people talk about this, or should white people defer to Black and Brown people to share about their experiences and teach about this? But then Black and Brown people are carrying the whole burden consistently mm-hmm. of doing the teaching and feeling all of the impact of it, and becoming more and more exhausted. If it's not spread out among all of the people who are caring, the ones who are leading are going to, you know, it's unsustainable.
Yeah, it's absolutely unsustainable. And I know, I mean, you brought up a point there that I think a lot of people do get concerned about, and it's good to be very conscious and aware of it. You know, am I speaking up and centering myself in a conversation at the expense of somebody else who has something to say or contribute here or wants to say something in this moment? Is a very different situation than, you know, this person is having to respond every single time. And, you know, they don't want to have to carry that load. Like, they're sick of it. Where are the supposed allies? The people that say that they care about this. So I do think that knowing some things that you can say in those moments can help you to feel more comfortable and confident when they occur. And, you know, a lot of times, sometimes these meetings might be, you know, a public moment and in literally a corporate setting or something where it's in front of a bunch of people and who's going to respond. I think a lot of missed opportunities are in our day-to-day lives with the people that we have relationships with and are talking to already, who are taking their news from different sources, perhaps, or hearing a very disproportionate amount of information from one perspective. And if we say like, oh, I just can't even, like, I'm done with it. If we all do that, then the cost is just too great. And so not everybody is going to be able to speak up all the time. But I think more of us feeling empowered that we have the tools to speak up more often and that we're taking care of ourselves so that we actually have the resources and are more likely to be in a state where we can speak up and can think clearly in that moment because we're not already so depleted. I think that's where those two pieces really go hand in hand.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense to me too. Oh, Rebecca, it's been really great talking with you about this very important subject. And where can people find more of what you're offering and what you're doing?
Well, certainly they can go to my website. That is RebeccaEPhD.com. That way people don't have to worry about knowing how to spell my last name correctly. You just have to spell the first name. And there's also the download that I mentioned, the 5 ways to speak up. That would be a way to get that resource and some support around how to use it, as well as, you know, if you're interested, please stay on the list. And I send out just weekly support and encouragement and resources. And that one is RebeccaEPhD.com/5 ways. That's for 5 ways to speak up.
Okay.
And certainly I'd love for people to connect with me on LinkedIn, send me a message, let me know any questions or anything that you really identified with or that spoke to you. I love to have conversations there as well. So people are welcome to message me on LinkedIn or connect with me there too.
Wonderful. Thank you. And I will put links to your LinkedIn, your download and your website on the show notes. But I've really enjoyed talking with you and I'm grateful for what you're doing because you're supporting the people who are out there making change. And so you're making change in that way as well. And I'm grateful for you staying in the work and helping people stay in the work.
Thank you. I mean, I'm so thankful to be doing the work that I'm doing. So it gives me as much back to it as I give, as I put in.
Well, it was a pleasure talking with you on Therapy Chat today. I'm so grateful that you were my guest.
Thanks, Laura. I'm grateful to be your guest and to be here and really enjoyed the conversation.
Therapy Notes is the highest rated EHR, practice management, and billing software for mental health professionals. Its all-in-one platform is designed to streamline all aspects of your practice, from connecting with clients via secure messages to scheduling, notes, billing, and more. You can trust Therapy Notes has you covered. And one of the best parts? 24/7 customer service with a live person. It's beyond easy to get help over the phone or by email at any time of day from their knowledgeable and friendly representatives. The best time to give Therapy Notes a try is now. Sign up for your free trial by going to therapynotes.com, clicking Start My Free Trial, and accessing your first 2 months free with the promo code CHAT. See why Therapy Notes is the most trusted EHR for behavioral health professionals today.
Therapists ready to stop just listening and start doing? I offer several ways to work with me and accelerate your trauma expertise. You can join my Trauma Therapist Network membership community for ongoing support, book a one-on-one clinical consultation with me for personalized guidance, or buy my course for clinicians on supporting survivors of sexual trauma, and check out the retreats coming up in 2026. All that info and more is on the For Therapists page of Trauma Therapist Network, and you can find a link in the show notes.
Thank you for listening to Therapy Chat with your host, Laura Reagan, LCSWC. For more information, please visit therapychatpodcast.com.